that we had come to the time of the Protestant Reformation, which is certainly in this world's history a monumental event. The Catholic Church had essentially, as we have seen, dominated Western religion from the Council of Nicaea, certainly from the time of the Imperial Restoration in the middle of the 6th century. And now for essentially 1,000 years, or a millennium, if you please, and that word comes into play even in this regard, the Catholic Church had control. But as we have also seen, in the couple of hundred years preceding the Reformation, the Catholic Church had grown so decadent, so corrupt, the priesthood, even the papacy, was corrupted beyond measure, that there were people stirring in the seeds of a beginning Reformation, and it was inevitable that a Martin Luther sooner or later would come along, looking at it strictly from a carnal sense. It just happened that it was Martin Luther who did appear on the scene. As you, I think, know, Luther is regarded as the greatest of the Protestant reformers by a good many Protestants, not all. But we do give him credit for that, historically, and in the Lutheran Church and other Protestant groups, Luther is thought to be the third greatest man to ever live. In the Christian world, Christ is given preeminence. Paul is usually regarded as second, and Luther third in importance, or in great men. So he does hold a great rank and high esteem in the eyes of many, many people. We don't hold him in quite the same regard because he was not part of the true church, but I think we must acknowledge his place in history. And we have the freedom to do what we do, in part because of Martin Luther. So we don't want to totally discount him. That is, if there had been no Protestant Reformation, can you imagine the world, let's say, religiously speaking, as Spain, to use an example? What if the whole Western world, religiously, were as the nation of Spain today? I mention Spain because they are more Catholic than Italians, even, in that sense of the word. Italians have been a little more liberal and loose with things, and there are more non-Catholics in Italy than there are in Spain. Or, let's say, the Latin world, which is generally regarded as among the most Catholic. Can you imagine the whole Western world dominated by that philosophy of teaching? That's what it would have been without Martin Luther, or who knows, couldn't have predicted. Had they been able to stamp out all heresy, would God's church have even totally been? Well, we know it wouldn't have been, because Christ said it would not have, that the gates of hell would never prevail against it. But can you imagine how much in hiding it would have had to have been had it not been for the Protestant Reformation? That did not make it totally easy, but it certainly made it a lot easier. So we should understand Martin Luther's place, I think, prominently in history, even as we may regard it. We certainly cannot accept Martin Luther's theology, but if you study church history, we at least ought to mention his name, and you ought to be familiar with a little bit about him. Martin Luther was a Catholic priest, a very brilliant young man. His father wanted him to enter a career in law. His mother was a very religious person. He was a very moody, even sometimes rebellious child. He said of himself that he had to be caned, was spanked or whipped many, many times during his younger years. And he did not have a good relationship with his father. So you see the psychology of the man a little bit, although I'm not going to psychoanalyze Luther here by any means. But it's very interesting what happened. As in the case of certain other men in history, there was an unusual event that took place in his life. He and his companions on one occasion were struck by lightning, a horrible thing to have happen. And of the group, I don't know how many there were, only Luther lived. The others were killed. The two or three other men with him were killed. This caused him to consider a career in the priesthood. He figured that God had spared his life and that he therefore felt like he was called to this. He entered a prominent university. He received his doctorate in theology. He was, as I have already mentioned, a brilliant man. To read the writings of Martin Luther, you are reading the skilled writings of a truly educated man in this world's way. He was a great musician. To this day, some of Martin Luther's hymns prevail And in the Protestant churches, in traditional hymnals, there will be a number of Martin Luther's compositions and hymns for Psalms. I don't think we have... Do we have any in our hymnal? I think his most prominent is "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God," but the chorale sings that, don't they? The chorale may sing some of Martin Luther's hymns, but there are many in the Protestant hymnals. We would not object to singing Martin Luther's hymns by any means if they were otherwise acceptable. He gave the world the translation of the Bible into German, which is not in itself a small accomplishment, of course. Monumental work to translate the Bible. He was a learned scholar of Hebrew and Greek. God simply did not, as far as I can view it, choose to reveal his truth to him. Maybe it was because of the kind of man he was, I don't know. But Luther did a lot of great things, and to this day, the Luther edition of the Bible is the acceptable or authorized German language edition of the Bible, even though translated in the 1500s, as our English King James edition was translated a little later into the 1600s, Luther's translation survives today. In more recent years, updated versions of the German language Bible are becoming more popular, just as in our own case we have the Moffat edition and the Revised Standard and the New English and the New International, and now perhaps the most popular of all, the modern, will become the new King James, because people want an attachment. I don't know if there is a new Luther version or not. Is there? Someone know anything about the German edition? There is an updated, a little more modernized text of the Luther edition, which is it still the most, is it then the acceptable Bible in Germany, in that sense of the word? So, this man did make a significant contribution to, as I said, the Western world, whether you agree with his theology or not, in the influence that he had. After receiving his doctorate in theology, he became a priest in the Catholic Church, but he was a little different kind of a priest. He did things more according to the book. He was very zealous. He was a man of more integrity in some ways than many of the other priests. He did things more slowly, more deliberately. People were always trying to hurry him up through the masses. He always took the time to hear people's confessions and told them what to do. He was puzzled at the papacy and its actions. He was puzzled at the priesthood in general. And finally, as I think I mentioned last time, when we come to 1517, he has grown so disconsolate with practices within the church that he tacks on the door of his own church congregation in Wittenberg what has come to be called the 95 Theses. These were 95 short points, and you can find them in a number of reference books. The majority of them had to do with indulgences. This was the practice, remember, of granting a special privilege, or in the afterlife, granting something for your stay in purgatory to be lessened or to be better for you if you did certain things in this life. Indulgences, by the way, later came to also include doing something now for your already dead relatives, so that you can do things now for your relatives who have already died and gone to purgatory. You can do indulgences for them. You can have masses said for them. You can do special services to the church, give money and things, and that will make it easier for your relatives as well as for you. I'm not up on the doctrine of indulgences, but that's a generalized statement on it. Luther was very discouraged about this, disagreed with it, and as a result of tacking these theses on the door of the church, he was considered non-desirable. It was however many years before he was officially excommunicated from the church. But the power the church had at this time, which we've described previously, caused Martin Luther to have to, as it were, go into hiding. And it was while he was in this hiding that the nobility of the Germanic kingdom gave him sanctuary. So he had the upper strata of German society on his side, especially in the north, the south remaining more religiously Catholic in Germany. So officially he was excommunicated in 1529. In the intervening years, he did his translation of the Bible into German, developed a lot of what became his theology, where he might differ from the Catholic Church. He did try to continue to work within the confines of the Church. 2 years after his attacking of the theses on the door of the Church, he wrote to the Pope regarding the Catholic Church as the Holy Church and the one true Church of God. He did not intend, it was not his purpose, to establish a new religion. But upon excommunication and through these things, there was really nothing left for him to do. He struggled through these years with the doctrines of infant baptism and idols and the doctrine of the Trinity. Basically, his studies led him to conclude what he had been taught in the Catholic Church. And thus, you do not find the Lutheran Church having departed radically from Catholicism. It is the most Catholic of all the Protestant groups. And if there ever is to be a reconciliation of Protestantism to Catholicism, it is presumed by most that the Lutherans will lead the way back into the Catholic Church. You might also include, in certain ways, the Church of England or the Anglican Church. It comes into the United States and other parts of the Western world as Episcopal Church. They may be close right behind, but maybe a slight step or two behind the Lutherans in their affinity to or similarity to Catholicism. Then you get into the radically departed groups of Unitarianism and Mennonites and Amish and Baptists and those kind of groups that are far, far from Catholics in many ways. And in between, I'll come to that on the chart a little bit later, you have Presbyterians and Methodists and Congregationalists and Church of Christ and other denominations that are sort of halfway between the extremist groups way out there on the right, like, as I said, Hutterites or Amish, as opposed to the Lutherans who are standing right next to the Catholics in many ways. And if they could ever resolve the problem of papal infallibility and papal authority, the way will be paved for Protestants to stream back into the Catholic Church. But not even the Lutherans or the Church of England, not even the Eastern Orthodox churches who are Catholic, can accept the power of the Pope. Now, I don't know how that's going to be resolved, if it is to be, in the fulfillment of events that come into the last time prophecies. But we'll, again, take that wait-and-see postures. Luther almost always acknowledged the Catholic Church as the true Church of God. So, he did, though, establish his church. He did not believe he was separating from it. He believed he was reforming it. And so it is called the Protestant Reformation now in history, and that title has stuck. What occurs in the 1500s is called the Protestant Reformation. So it is a group of protesters reforming the church. Now this makes it very difficult to categorize these people we've been talking about, the Waldensians, the Petrobrusians. Now we'll be calling them Sabbatarians from this point forward. Groups of people who kept the Sabbath and or had other doctrines that differed from the Catholic Church but were never part of it. See, Protestant Reformation, and the word Protestant in itself, implies coming out of the Catholic Church, protesting against it. So you've probably had some little struggle, maybe a time or two, filling out an application for a job or something, when religious preference is asked, and you only have two choices. Catholic or Protestant, if you're Christian. And maybe you've got an other box, and you wonder what you should do if you put other. Well, others generally meant Islam, Judah, Jewish. That's what other means on those applications, so you have to figure out what to do. Well, just for the sake of the way the world views it, I don't think there's anything wrong with your putting the Protestant box in, if you have to check it. Sometimes it's better just to leave it blank and let them assume, although they're going to find out pretty quick you are a rabid Christian. So then they're going to look on that sheet and say, well, wait a minute. He didn't put anything down. Here he is religious. He's demanding holy days, and he doesn't eat these things, and he's asking for time off, and he refuses to work on the Sabbath day or on Saturday, and yet he didn't check anything religious. So I suppose the best thing to do, in the way they view it, Protestant means not a Catholic. But in the classic sense of the word, Protestant means those who came out of the Catholic Church in an attempt to reform religion. And we are none of the above. So they don't give us a category. You know, it's kind of hard to niche us. But just for the sake of the way the world views it, I suppose most of the time it's better to check the Protestant box and avoid having to go into a 45-minute explanation of what you are, which probably was not something they're interested in anyway. So use wisdom on that, and don't worry about it if you have to do such a thing. But Luther intended to reform the church, and we do find the term, and I have heard sometimes people in the past say that the Catholic Church has never been called the Church of God, and I don't know where that came from, because that's what they do call themselves. Over the many centuries now, Catholic has come to be the name of the church, Roman Catholic, signifying the church headquartered out of Rome. Of course, you have the Eastern Orthodoxy, and then you have these dozens and what comes to be later hundreds of denominations in the Christian world. But the Catholic Church does call itself the Church of God. And that's the word Catholic, as I've explained before, simply means universal. So in one sense of the word, the name of their church and the name of this church are essentially the same. Worldwide Church of God and Catholic Church of God mean the same thing. So we should not make the mistake that the Catholics have never called themselves the Church of God. They have. And you see that through their literature. It's not what they commonly call themselves, because Catholic is such a word of recognition now. But it used to be Catholic Church of God, then it became the Roman Catholic Church of God, then it became Roman Catholic, and that's what stuck over now the last many centuries, so that no one thinks of it in any other way. Luther developed some interesting doctrines. The major doctrine that he had to wrestle with, though, because he saw this harsh and severe practice in the Catholic Church, the doctrines of penance and the doctrine of reconciliation and salvation. He struggled with those things, of this very legalistic way of life. So Luther, in his studies, in his relationship to God, developed the doctrine, now popular in most of the Protestant world, called the doctrine of grace. Luther saw the Catholics trying to obtain salvation by law. He saw in the Bible that grace, free unmerited pardon, was offered by God, and the theology of law versus grace becomes really the major splitting point, in that sense of the word, between what Luther developed and what the Protestant world has as a significantly major difference in doctrine of the Catholic Church, although there are many, many differences as we go down through time. But Luther saw grace as the way. And thus he concluded that it was free, unmerited pardon, that there was nothing for you to do. Thus the abolition of the law comes into Protestant theology, more than in Catholic theology. The abolition of the law. You don't have to keep the law. We are now under grace, and we are saved by grace. Luther carried this so far that he could not accept the Epistle of James as inspired scripture, because James said you had to do the works of the law. He didn't understand what James said. And one occasion, Martin Luther said the epistle of James is an epistle of straw. And on another occasion, he said it ought not be in the Bible. So he did not accept it. He didn't like James. And he saw it contradicting Paul. So Luther spent a lot of time developing his theology with the writings of the Apostle Paul, and is very often compared with Paul, in the sense of the world's viewpoint of how you do it. But his obsession with the doctrine of grace versus the doctrine of the law led him to a very, very major error. And that is, he developed the theology that you are saved by grace alone, and there is nothing you have to do. So obsessed by this was he that he inserted it in his translation of the Bible in a verse that doesn't have it in the Greek. He inserted the word alone. I want to read you the English verse in Romans chapter 3 and verse 28. You don't need to take your Bibles out and look it up. Just write it down. Romans 3, 28. Here is what Paul said, translated into English. Therefore we conclude that a man is justified by faith without the deeds of the law. Now, I'm not going to go into an explanation of the doctrine of faith and grace here, but you remember the verse. We conclude that a man is justified by faith without the deeds of the law. in the German edition, I'll translate it into English loosely at least for you, the same verse, Martin Luther says, "So we hold, therefore, that men, or that mankind, is saved or will be saved without the law's works alone through faith." Alone through faith. He puts the German word, A-L-L-E-I-N, a line, which means alone, in the text. And it is not in the Greek. Now, I can't claim anything why he did that. It's just an interesting observation that he was so consumed by his passion of understanding about the grace that he misunderstood it, and went so far as to feel free to insert a word in the translation that wasn't there. It's a sad thing. One should not do that. If you ever choose to translate the Bible, be very careful that you adhere to it. It could have been a legitimate and honest mistake. I'm not making any accusations, but it's interesting to note, at least. And there were other books of the Bible he didn't care much about. He didn't care for the book of Revelation. And I don't think he liked the 1st and 2nd John that he didn't care about either. Don't remember why now, but there were various books. Yeah, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, as well as the book of Revelation, he said, were not as inspired with the rest of the scripture as the rest of the scriptures. He said Jude should end the Bible and James should not be in it. So he didn't have the point of view that God could have used him if he'd had a mind that had said, whatever God's will is, I will do. I want the truth. This does not take away from, again, his greatness as a human being, but that's sort of the way he was. But he did retain the idea of infant baptism and, to a degree, the doctrine of predestination, but that was to be later developed by yet another theologian to come along just shortly after his time, or overlapping him to a degree. I will mention a couple of other then reformers, skip along through the time, so that you're familiar with the names. In Switzerland and in southern Germany, there was a man named Zwingli, Z-W-I-N-G-L-I, Zwingli, from 1484 to 1581 was his lifespan. Within the Catholic Church, Zwingli was a scholar who promoted the Catholic idea of humanism. Humanism has always been a part of Catholic philosophy in one way or another. We have sort of a rightist group within the Catholic Church of humanists. And then, of course, that has evolved in our time into secular humanism, which has sort of taken itself out of religion totally and become a very popular modern philosophy. But Zwingli was a humanist within the Catholic Church. He published ideas about it and paved the way. I mention him because he paved the way for the next great Protestant reformer, and in some ways his accomplishments even greater than Martin Luther's. His name was Calvin, C-A-L-V-I-N, and his time frame is 1509 to 1564. So after Martin Luther in importance, we would come to the time of Calvin. Calvin develops the philosophy and theology that is prominent now in a majority of mainstream Protestant churches, apart from the Lutherans. And that includes many. We'll come to it on that chart in a second then. Calvin began his work in Switzerland after Martin Luther's, let's say, beginning of the Protestant Reformation. That time he follows along with a very strict theology and separates himself from the Roman Catholic Church and gains both religious and political control in much of Switzerland. The interesting thing about Calvin is he was no better now than his Catholic predecessors. It was just in a new jacket. A very harsh, a very severe man. Extremely ascetic. Ruthless in his methods. He had people executed. He had people tortured. He had terrible things done to people because they would not follow his theology. He became virtually a dictator. Some say he was more dictatorial than any Catholic pope has ever been. He put a lot of stress on rejecting the pleasures of life. Life was to sort of be an ascetic, severe type of a situation, and if people were not willing to do that, then he had them punished. And when you think of the evolution of religion in the Protestant world and what comes out of Calvinism, you have the Presbyterian Church is the major church of the world that is Calvinistic. But out of it comes the Puritan movement of England, in part, although the Puritan movement also is very much influenced by the non-Catholic Christians we've already talked about, the Waldensians, although they're Sunday keepers. But when you think of strict religion, and if you Americans at least, you think of the Puritans who came to this country, some of the things you know about their religious practices, very severe in what they required people to do. And the severe religious groups such as Hutterite and Mennonite and the Amish peoples who live a very rigid lifestyle, very strict by at least modern standards, and some of the things that these people did in their religion and their theology. And they believed that people were headed for hell, not so much because hell was preached too much, but because it was not preached enough. And so you have this hellfire and damnation kind of preaching that comes into the Protestant world as well. And this is why the peoples, let's say, of Assemblies of God, the Pentecostal movement, that type of thing, preach so much. It's just their philosophy, going back to Calvin, that you have to dangle people over the fires of Gehenna to scare them so that they will do the things they're supposed to do. And that's a traditional Protestant, even Baptist, ploy. I mean, the evangelists may say, if you don't repent tonight, you could get hit by a car on the way home from this evangelistic meeting. You must give your heart to the Lord tonight. You know, this very day may be your last. And they dangle people over hell. Billy Graham doesn't do it now as much as he used to, but years ago he used to preach a little more that way. Not in any Pentecostal way, but in that sort of give your heart to the Lord tonight, it may be your last and only chance. And you could, of course, if you're not saved, have to spend eternity in hell. And scare tactics of people. So when you read about Calvin, you're reading about the development of that kind of severe theology, a very rigid lifestyle of asceticism. There are five main points of Calvinism that you ought to be familiar with, and then you understand more the Protestant world that you will sometimes come in contact with, and of course many of you in the future will help out and visit with ministers and serve maybe in the ministry yourself, some of you. You want to know how to help people who have had this teaching and training in their lives, whether they're Methodist or Presbyterians or Church of Christ or Episcopalian. This philosophy is the undertone of those churches. So the five main points of Calvinism are, one, man is totally depraved. That is, he is altogether bad, born that way. Secondly, Calvin believed in the doctrine of unconditional predestination. That is, he thought that it was predetermined prior to your human birth whether you would be saved or whether you would be lost. And there was nothing you can do about it. Now, that's what a diabolical doctrine it is. Then you might ask the question, well, now, if that's the case, why does the church go to the effort of doing any work? What's the purpose of the church if you are either consigned to die in hell, burn in hell forever, or go to heaven when you die? Protestants now delete the intermediate stage of purgatory, both Luther and Calvin. Take out the intermediate stage of purgatory. And so the question is logical, why would you do this? Well, the next point sort of answers that. That is, third point, redemption is granted to the elect. And it is the job of the church to go out to grant to preach the gospel so that the elect can hear it. In other words, God will not call them apart from the church. So the church is essential in the redemption process to go out and find the elect, to go out and preach the gospel, that God will then call the elect through the church into that way of life, and thus they will be redeemed and headed for salvation. That fourth he believed that grace is irresistible. That if you are predestined to go to heaven, to be part of that group, that you cannot resist it. That when the call comes to you, you will respond to it. When the knowledge comes your way, you will respond. You cannot deny, you cannot turn from it, that God intends for you to be in heaven. Therefore, you will be in heaven. The church will get its word to you. You will accept it. You cannot deny it. And fifth, they believe, once you're saved, you're always saved. You cannot fall from grace. Once you're saved, you're always saved. Now, they take off in all directions from there and are modified. You know, the Baptist will come with... The Baptists don't have this doctrine of unconditional predestination. The Baptists believe you've got to go out and win souls for Christ, and that it is free moral agency, that you can resist. And I think other churches, many other churches do too. But this formed the basis for what we consider the traditional Protestant viewpoint. Now, you can find really none of those doctrines in the Bible. We don't believe any of that, right? We don't believe man is totally depraved. Now, you can perhaps understand. If you think back, and maybe it's very difficult for you to relate to, many of you having been many years a part of God's church, when Mr. Armstrong began to understand the truth of the Spirit in man, what a revelation that was of doctrine. To you, you probably take it as very common. You probably think we always believe that. But we didn't know. We didn't understand. There was a time we wrestled with this idea of, are you born evil? Are you born bad? If you'll go back and read the earliest articles on child rearing from the late 50s and early 60s, you will see an undertone of that idea that we are born evil, and you gotta beat it out of the little character, you know, as he goes through his life until he becomes an adult. It was sort of that philosophy, Calvinistic. And it even influenced the way we thought until we came to understand more completely the doctrine of the Spirit in man. And that we are indeed born essentially neutral. We are not hostile to God at birth, a little tiny baby, but we are subject to influences. And the prince of the power of the air can broadcast. We as parents can train our children to see the importance of knowing the truth of these things and what you can do in counteracting evil influences. And there are then inherent things, I think, within us, a certain selfishness that is a part of life. But I think we certainly feel without doubt now that man is not born totally depraved. We do not believe in unconditional predestination. We do not believe God has predetermined in advance before you were born, or while you were in the womb, or shortly after you were born, that you would be saved, or you would be lost. He certainly has never decreed you would be lost. At some point, he decreed he would call you. I don't know what point that was. But God at some point decreed he would call you, give you this opportunity, but you can turn it down. So you see, we don't accept any of Calvin's views at all. But you should understand the basis for theology, and maybe then you will understand some of the differences between the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church in a very brief way. This at least sets you the stage so you can see how they separated. And beginning in the 1500s, we have a Western world now divided into essentially two camps, Catholic and Protestant, that is Christian, religious camps, Catholic and Protestant, and in the course of time, we have developed into splits and sects and denominations and cults and groups of people to where now I think the count is the denominations within Christianity now are something like 400 to 500 of them, started out with what the Catholics would say was one. Remember, we've always observed there have always been people who were never Catholic. So we always have a separate group of the true church. I want to give you just a couple of more names to be familiar with in the Protestant Reformation, and then we'll skip to that chart and show the development of what happened. John Knox is a name you should know, K-N-O-X, John Knox, 1514 to 1572. He established Calvinism in Scotland. And so today, the Protestant Church of the north of Britain, in Scotland, is what has become the Presbyterian Church in America. It is called the Evangelical Church in some sections of Europe. They don't necessarily use the term Presbyterian. But John Knox started the Calvinist movement in Scotland, and thus northern England, Scotland, would be, generally speaking, what we would call in America, in the United States, we would call the Presbyterian Church. But it is, what is it called in Scotland? Is it called Presbyterian there too? Then John Wesley comes along a little later, 1703 to 1791. John Wesley starts his movement in England. But of all things, it does not succeed in England, I guess because the Church of England, the state church, and the Calvinist Church of the North, and the Catholic Church of Ireland makes it difficult to bring much new into the English realm. And so John Wesley's movement became popularized in the colonies. In the United States of America, you know it today as the Methodist Church. This is the formation of the Methodist Church in the time of John Wesley. It began in England, but could not prosper there. And so among the colonists of the New World were many Methodists. And in fact, Methodist is one of the major U.S. Protestant churches. Now, if you'll go to the chart, we'll perhaps be able to visualize then the development of religion in the Christian world. I hope it won't be too confusing to you to follow your lines along. But let's say, starting with the time of Christ, I have on the right-hand side of the page then, the date line, we have drawn in some of the names, certainly the key names, where we would find God's people throughout the ages. From the earliest apostles starting the church, they were called Nazarenes, Paulicians, Bogomils, Waldenses. We could put Sabbatarians and perhaps should in there. Just under Seventh-day Church of God, you might want to write Sabbatarians. In fact, Stephan, if we can get that on the chart, it would be good. You can put your own other titles in anywhere you would like. And Seventh-day Church of God should really be a little higher on that list, I think, a little higher on the chart, slightly. Where Mr. Armstrong came in contact with the truth, and then, of course, on into our time today, there. Now, what we have happening, apart from the true church, so that's, you know, we'll set that aside. The true church is over there. It has its own history, apart from the development of all other religious organizations. Now we have, shortly after the time of Jesus, and I've tried to draw the box up there, so that it makes some sense, I hope, a variety of religious philosophies and personalities. Gnosticism, Mithraism, Cerinthus, Simon Magus, and their type. It's not meant to be definitive or the last word, but you have those kind of peoples and philosophies beginning to mix together or syncretize a whole school of thought. And there are different ones. Now we come to the Council of Nicaea in 325, going up the chart. And out of that, we solidify the Roman Catholic Church, and I've taken it off to the left. Then, or straight up, the Roman Catholic Church and that which is to come out of it. Off to the left of the Council of Nicaea. But at the same time, we have people who do not claim to be part of the Catholic Church, but that we do not recognize, as much as we can gather from information about them, were they part of the true church either. And so on the right-hand side, I've drawn another little arrow over to give ground to the people who claim never to have been Catholic, thus not Protestant in the same way we do, but then how do you reconcile the idea that they're not the true church? Well, we never said that you couldn't have 4, 15, or 32 developing things going at the same time. So I've drawn a line over there to show Ebionites, Manichaeans, Cathars, Hutterites, Mennonites, Mormons, Seventh-day Adventists, Jehovah's Witnesses, and Christian Scientists, and the like, other denominations could fit in there too, who do not claim to have their origins in the Roman Catholic system. Now, some of these claim ancient origins. The Albigenses, the Anabaptists, the Hutterites trace their histories back, sometimes through the same peoples we do, the Waldenses, the Bogomils, the Polesians. There are others who come along at a later time, and they are modern, they have a modern foundation, and don't claim any ancient origin. For example, the Mormons don't claim ancient history. They claim their origins, the days of Joseph Smith's revelation, or alleged revelation, and the binding of these tables and so on. You've perhaps studied that in another class. The Jehovah's Witnesses, as an example, don't claim any, history of the church, the Christian Scientists, the Foursquare Gospel. There are numerous organizations that have come into being, as opposed to, let's say, the Jerry Falwells, who's a Baptist, or the Jim Baker PTL Club, which is Assemblies of God, and those kind. They have ancient histories. Others of them start new religions. We claim, the Seventh-day Adventists started their own religion in the days of William Miller and Ellen G. White. I'll come to that a little later. Well, we don't have much later, but we will touch on it briefly to show the development of the Adventist Church. But they're separate. They don't claim origins back through Catholicism at all. So you have, from the Council of Nicaea, as it were, two separate groups going that are not true church. And then they may branch out in a variety of ways, as we see with the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church is formed in 325, or has, let's say it's not formed, has come to its authority in 325. But it also has its own developments. Straight up is the Roman Catholic Church. I've carried it on right on through, but it's a jagged line, so I could put the other titles in there. If you want to make it a straight line, you'll have to make your chart about 4 feet wide, see? So to get it on one piece of paper, I've had to jog the lines around. The Catholic Church is divided into two groups, the Roman Catholic and the Eastern Orthodox. The numbers in parentheses, by the way, are the approximate number of people in millions, unless otherwise noted, that presently practice that religion. So Roman Catholics, 580 million. Eastern Orthodox, 125 million, as an example. Some of the other more modern movements I put up there, the Mennonites, the Mormons, the Adventists, and so on, giving you some numbers so that you can see the size of them. On the left-hand side of the page, you'll notice a comparison in numbers of people who practice a religious philosophy, Christian, Islam, Hindu, Buddhist, and so on, down the line of what they are. Okay, now coming up the line then from Roman Catholic Church, you have the Eastern Orthodox. The Roman Catholic goes straight up. Now we split off in the Protestant Reformation, as we have been talking about today. And the Protestant Reformation occurs, and you have then, I've drawn it over to the right because it's singular in the sense of its foundation in history, the Lutheran Church. 75 million people in the world. See what a tremendous number of people practice these religions. And then we have to go around the left-hand side of the page, because about the same time Luther was creating his church in Germany, King Henry VIII split off the church, the Catholic Church in England, and made it a state church under his, the king's, direction, and it became the Church of England, or Anglican Church. And it has its own history. You kind of trace that around, and it becomes the Episcopal Church in America. Some segments of the Congregational Church and Unitarians have also split off from that. So you have the development of the Anglican Church. Then you have the Calvinistic philosophy that I was mentioning just a few moments ago, and it splits into a variety of groups in its philosophy. On the right-hand side, as we come into the middle of the page there, The so-called, when I say Christian, I don't mean that as a generic term, meaning all Christians. I mean a denominational term. The Christian Church. And it's forevermore combining and dividing, it seems like. And in the Christian Church, we have the Disciples of Christ, the Presbyterians, the Reformed Church, and the Churches of Christ. Some of those groups are combinations of previous groups, called Congregationalists, was a major... By the time you were born, probably Congregationalist was not a denomination any longer, but they became part of the United Churches of Christ. When I was a youngster growing up, there was a church denomination called Congregational. The Congregational Church. It was like the Methodist Church, the Baptist Church, the Presbyterian Church, and on the next corner was the Congregationalist Church. Then down the road was the Church of Christ. Well, they all got together, not all, but some of them got together, and formed the United Churches of Christ. So you have this Christian church movement, which is a denominational term within the confines of the generic term, Christian. And it's part of the Calvinistic movement. Then on the left, the Pentecostals, the Methodists, the Assemblies of God, and the Baptists won't like me, but I have also placed them there. The Baptists claim that they do not come through the Calvinistic movement, that they come through the Waldensians. And I'm not going to argue the point of the history. I placed them there theologically, however. And while the Baptists may differ from the Congregationalists or the Presbyterians or the Lutherans in certain doctrines of theology, the underlying current of theology in the Baptist world is far more identifiable with Calvin than it is the Bible, the true Church of God, right? I mean, you compare Baptist theology with the true theology of the Bible, and it is infinitely more related to the Calvinistic Protestant development than it is the true history. They don't keep the holy days, they don't keep the Sabbath, they keep the pagan holidays, they keep the Lord's Supper and not the Passover. They believe in the doctrine of once saved, always saved, although not in the Calvinistic tradition. And on and on and on it goes. So the Baptists are not related to, I don't think, any part of the true church. But they would put themselves over there in the place of us, in fact, is where they would place themselves. So that will give you, I hope, at a glance, and sometime when you're in a discussion with someone and they don't understand the development, how come so many religions, where did it all start, how did it come to be? You see the major influences here, at least I think on this chart, of those kind of things. So we will spend, as I mentioned to you last time then, the rest of our class periods, which is not very many remaining, on understanding how the Sabbath keepers of Europe established themselves and came to America, and we'll have to leave it off there for you to discuss with or to read in the autobiography, which is readily available.